Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. Today's date is the 7th of January, year of our Lord, 2014, and it's a Tuesday. I remember today Melody is bye-bye. She's had a little bit of a problem, has to be dealt with. And she's going to take care of that, and I will be handling the program on my own, solo. No one to help me or assist me other than Frank, the producer, and you know what that means. It means I'm probably in big trouble. Let's talk about the gold markets and the silver markets and platinum and palladium and the metals and the equities. Gold is down $5.10 today. To $1,233.70. Silver is down 29 cents to $19.98 per ounce. Platinum's off $2 to $1,421. Palladium is up $2 to $745 per ounce. What else have we got here? We've got the Dow Jones is up 114 points to 16,539. NASDAQ's up 42 points to 4,156. New York Stock Exchange is up 59 points to 10,329. U.S. dollar index is up 0.19 to 80.86. And crude oil is up 41 cents to $93.84 per barrel. You got to admit, crude oil is having something of a surprising time. I'm not sure if it's surprising, but a little bit surprising. I would expect the price to be closer to $100 a barrel. They have to be concerned in the oil patch. The producers have to be a little concerned that the price is down to $93.84 a barrel. I don't think it's a cause for panic or enormous concern, but nevertheless, they have to be worried about it a little bit. And you watch these things happen, and you try to put all the pieces together, and you try to understand as best you can why some prices go up and other prices go down. But to some degree, it's like squeezing a balloon. You know, you get one of those long sausage-shaped balloons, and you squeeze it at one place, and it bulges someplace else. And you can squeeze it with two hands, and you get a couple of different bulges, and so on. The economy is like that. You know, when it's the complete interrelationship between all of the different investments and factors and so on is so complex that if you just push on one point, you can be much surprised at the ultimate reaction. You can push down at one point, and at another point that would superficially seem to be completely unrelated, all of a sudden it goes up. And you wonder, is there a relationship, or is this just randomness? There is something about economics in general that's more like reading tea leaves. They try to describe it as a science, but I don't believe it is. I don't believe you can call economics a science, because there is so much that is subjective and so much that's based on things like human psychology. Everyone understands that confidence is the foundation for the strength of the economy, and particularly the strength of the dollar. And confidence is such a subjective concept, and trying to calculate how much confidence do I have, and how much confidence do you have, and how much do the people across the street have, and how much do the people in California and Pennsylvania, you know, trying to make that calculation extremely difficult and impossible, really. You can't do it. You can make guesstimates, you can make hunches, but you can't know what the confidence is. And insofar as confidence is critical to economic functioning, you know, the whole science, the alleged science of economics, again, it is more like reading tea leaves than it is like a real science. Here's an article from Personal Liberty Digest. Obama renews gun control push. Study shows gun control increases crime. On Friday, just 3 days into the new year, President Barack Obama signaled a renewed administrative push for stronger gun control legislation as he announced a new executive action designed to make it easier to clarify Americans as mentally ill for the purpose of revoking Second Amendment rights. But as the White House hints that 2014 will bring a new round of efforts to make gun ownership in the United States more restrictive, a recent analysis of crime statistics published by Applied Economic Letters undermines almost every argument used by proponents of stronger gun regulations. We're going to get back to that in just a moment. What Obama is including in his new and improved regulations, people who voluntarily committed themselves to a mental health facility can be denied firearms on an outpatient basis, as well as an inpatient and non-voluntary commitments. And the reason that's dangerous is because if a judge in a courtroom decides that you might be mentally ill, he can commit you. All right? And this happens, where the judge says, I don't think you're mentally, you know, correct. You're mentally stable, and therefore they ship you off, and it happens to people. And what this report on Obama's new procedures indicates, or at least implies, is that if a judge, you go to court as a pro se litigant, and you attempt to defend yourself, and you use theories based on the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence or something other than what lawyers generally use in court, the judge can ship you off for mental health care. And once you've done that under Obama's newly proposed regulations, once you've been shipped off for mental health care, it may be that you will never be able to legally purchase a firearm again. So, what does all of this indicate? Well, it indicates in part you've got to be crazy to go anywhere for mental health care. Huh? That's kind of a joke. You get that? You've got to be crazy to go to mental health care. Well, because if you take mental health care, you may not be able to get a firearm. But here's some more about it. Here's the other thing that rings my bell that is fascinating about the story. And it says a recent analysis of crime statistics published by Applied Economic Letters undermines almost every argument used by proponents of stronger gun regulations. And the point to all of this is that it is apparent that the communities that have the strongest gun control regulations are typically also the communities that have the highest incidence of crime and also murder. Right? I met a woman who goes to my church. She and her husband moved here to Texas, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I guess, I'm not sure. But they'd previously lived in Boston and New York City and Chicago, and they particularly talked about New York City and Chicago and the strong gun regulations they had there. And these people were liberals. They lived in those communities or in those cities, and their mentality was that of liberals. They believed in the left-wing agenda. But the lady I'm talking to at the church, she said particularly she talked about Chicago. When she drove around in Chicago, she couldn't put her purse on the seat next to her in the car. She had to set the purse down on the floor by the passenger seat and then put something over it where it was not instantly apparent where it was or what it was. And the reason was that if you were stopped at an intersection, somebody could walk up next to the car, punch a hole through the passenger window, reach in and grab the purse. So she said she learned over the years driving in Chicago, in particular, that's what she mentioned. And she talked about she was nearly assaulted in New York City and Chicago on three different occasions. Didn't come to it, but it was close. And she said that you learned when you drive, you don't pull right up to the bumper of the car in front of you when you're stopped at a stoplight or a stop sign. Because if you do, you can't go forward, you can't go back, car comes behind you, you are trapped. She said she always drove where she would leave plenty of space in front of her and try to have space to either the right side or the left side, where if she had to put her foot on the gas and get out of there, she had an escape route. She wasn't trapped. She just learned to do that as a normal part of life, and this was in cities that have extreme gun control regulations. And then they moved down here to Texas. They live here in Dallas. And she said she was here for a couple of years, and all of a sudden she realized... You don't have to put your purse on the floorboard. And you don't have to park at intersections when you drive up to a stoplight and a stop sign, there's a car in front of you. You don't have to park where you're not bumper to bumper. Leave yourself some space where you can make a fast getaway if you have to. You don't have to do that down here. And she realized the reason is because Texas has guns. I'm going to make you a bet that 20% at least of the people that attend my church are there with concealed carry. They wear their guns to church. You understand? And I'm glad they do. And that's the reason why nobody is going to pop your window and grab in and reach in on the passenger side and try to steal your purse. Because they understand that while they're grabbing for your purse, you may be grabbing for your handgun and put a round in their head. Nobody does that down here in Texas. And she said it was an epiphany, a moment when she began to realize, my God, gun control is crazy. When enough people have guns, a lot of people decide, better mind our manners and remain in a civilized, conduct ourselves as civilized human beings. So in any case, here's Barack Obama. He wants to take more guns away. And even though there is mounting evidence that's consistent with the story of the lady I was just telling you about. She can put her purse on the seat next to her. Why? Because people in Texas carry guns. That's why. She hasn't been assaulted. She hasn't been threatened. She's not even concerned. She's living a more relaxed lifestyle in a state where people can carry guns than she was able to live in Chicago and in New York, under circumstances where people cannot carry guns. Then the lesson's clear and the lesson's obvious that guns are conducive to liberty, to freedom, to security, and gun control is conducive to crime. Here's the next one. Obama, of course, here's this one article. He's going to renew gun control push, but here's another article from the Washington Times. And it says, gun sales hit new record, ammo boom to follow. Background checks show peak is reached after a record year. Gun records checks fueled by a post-Newtown boom of gun sales hit a new high in 2013. And industry analysts expect ammunition to be the big seller this year as consumers catch up to all those firearms purchases. More than 21 million applications were run through the National Instant Criminal Background Check last year, marking a nearly 8% increase and the 11th straight year that the numbers have risen. And this is so It's funny on one level. Obama's pushing for gun control, even though evidence indicates gun control doesn't work. And the people are saying, nope, we're getting our guns. 21 million applications for owning firearms were run through this last, were run through the national system in the last, in 2013. That's not 20 million total. That's 21 million on top of how many other people already have guns. All right? 21 million, that's a 15th of the population. More than that, it's probably 10% of the American people bought guns for the first time last year. All right? An additional 10%. How many additional 10% do we need before just about everybody has guns? And the answer is not many. A couple more years like that, and they're going to have a hard time selling guns in this country because everyone will have so many. But it's interesting, Obama wants to increase gun control, but the people are saying to heck with that. The people do have brains enough. They understand that they are safer with guns than they are without them. And we can reasonably ask ourselves, we know, the evidence is clear, it's undeniable, that as you have more guns in the community, crime rates tend to go down. I won't say that the evidence is unequivocal. You know, there may be some instances where more guns cause more problems. There may be some instances, but predominantly it's the opposite way. More guns, less crime. Obama's trying to ignore that. The American people are not buying it. And every time he says, oh, we need more gun control, what do the people do? Buy more guns. Right? It's got to be frustrating for the president. We talked a little about this yesterday, I believe. We touched on the idea that Obamacare is in such a dire condition and subject to so much criticism and has so many flaws and so many inconsistencies and so many offensive and oppressive elements that President Obama doesn't, he'll talk about anything other than Obamacare, then it's reasonable to presume that he may intentionally advocate programs like more gun control, even though he knows it's stupid, even though he knows it isn't going to work. He may advocate it simply to get people talking about gun control rather than Obamacare. It remains to be seen. We don't know for a fact that that's true, but it's certainly, it's one of those things that is at least probable. Right? So we'll watch. Gun control, they really want gun control, or do they merely want something, anything to talk about besides Obamacare? For example, here's Evander Holyfield. Evander Holyfield's former heavyweight champion, boxing champion. And Evander, you know, I like that guy. I've seen him at the aftermath of one of his, I don't even remember who he fought, and it was probably Mike Tyson. And I believe it was in a match that he was not favored to beat Mike Tyson for heavyweight champion. And he did. And it was all very remarkable and astonishing. And they had people up there that were interviewing him, and the guys say, well, what did you think about this and that, and which round do you think things changed in your favor, and so on. And Evander Holyfield insisted on giving credit to his victory to our Father, the good Lord. All right? He insisted on it. And you could see the announcer visibly annoyed that he couldn't get Evander to stop talking about God and giving credit to God. And this was interesting because Mike Tyson had claimed he was going to go in there and fight for Allah and the Muslim faith. Well, I like Evander. He's a good man. He impresses me. I like the guy. So in any case, he was on a British version of a reality show, Celebrity Big Brother. Former boxing champion said that homosexuality was a choice. He likened the sexual orientation to someone who was born handicapped. And he was essentially saying it's not the way you're born, it's a choice that is and can be made. The show's host, then, that I'm reading from Washington Times, the show's host took the boxer to task. Before you entered the Big Brother's house, Rules regarding unacceptable language and behavior were explained to you last night in a conversation with Louisa. You expressed the view that being gay was not normal and that it could be fixed. Well, it can't be fixed. It's time we have to take our commercials, and we're going to do that right now. When we come back, we'll talk more about Evander's decision to criticize the homosexual community and how this woke up, wound up. I'm Alfred Addis, here on Financial Survival. Be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate in those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Or take your chances with the bad boys. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. We're talking about Evander Holyfield. He's appearing on a British television program where he remarked to one of the other people on the program that homosexuality was a choice rather than an act of nature in the sense that we're born that way. And he espoused the biblical belief that homosexuality is wrong. It's a choice. It's like a choice between right and wrong. And it was his contention that homosexuality was wrong, and it was wrong because the Bible said so. Shows how host came and harassed him and told him, look, before you can't, there's things you can't say, and went on and gave Evander a lecture. And this is interesting. You can start giving a man a lecture who was a former heavyweight boxing champion. You know, it's the sort of thing, I don't know if I want to give that guy a lecture. You understand? Nevertheless, the producer did, director, whoever was responsible, host. And he said, while Big Brother understands that these are the views you hold, they aren't the views that are held by a large section of society. and expressing these views will be extremely offensive to many people. Do you understand why? The host said. I was just telling her my opinion. This is Holyfield. He says, I was just telling her my opinion. It's not like I was going to mention it to anybody else. That was just our conversation. The incident sparked a flurry of admonitions on Twitter. The website salon.com tweeted, stop telling gay people to stop being gay. And openly gay singer Boy George said it was a shame to hear Mr. Holyfield's words. I disagree, you know. I'm not going to tell gay people to stop being gay, per se. I don't necessarily agree that some people aren't, you know, I recognize the possibility that some people may be born that way. I don't know if that's true or false. I recognize the possibility. I don't regard it as if we had 100 people who were gay, I would suppose that it may be that 1-5% of them may have been born that way. But I would say for my opinion, 95%, it's personal choice. If you want to make that choice, it's your business. I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to stop you from making that choice. But what I am going to say is this, you need to look at all the information. And it's not just that the people in the homosexual community need to look at all the information. That information needs to be made available to all of the people in this country, including children in grade schools and high schools that are being taught that homosexuality is just another lifestyle choice. And you have an option to be gay if you want to be gay. It's not a problem, not cause for concern. The problem with it is this. Back in the 1980s, when the AIDS epidemic first broke out, the federal government passed federal laws that prevent insurance actuaries from tracking the causes of death in relationship to homosexuals. They'll say you died, but they may even say you died of AIDS, but they're not going to say you died. There won't be an association made with homosexuals. Actuaries are people who track all forms of human behavior, and they discover what kinds of behavior are consistently applicable to an early death. And they know, for example, I mean, this is an exaggeration, it's not true, but it's intended to illustrate a point, that if you wear bow ties, people who wear bow ties tend to live 15 months longer than people who don't wear bow ties. Maybe it's only 5 days, maybe it's only 15 weeks. I don't know what the number is. I'm just guessing. But they track all of this so they can calculate on the insurance premiums properly, and they know that you, because you wear a bow tie, shouldn't have to pay the same premiums as someone else who wears a conventional tie. But they can't track death rates since the 1980s in terms of whether you are homosexual or not. And as a result, we don't have extensive information on what the life expectancy for gays is. But the information was tracked by one doctor in particular, and I don't recall his name. I published some of his work back in the 1990s in a little magazine I was publishing, and he tracked it, and it was his conclusion that the average homosexual at that point lost at least 20 years on average. I won't say at least, but on average, 20 or more years of life expectancy by virtue of being, of choosing to be gay. Which means the lifestyle choice advocated by the homosexual community is more lethal than the lifestyle choice of smoking cigarettes or chewing tobacco. You are more likely to die from homosexuality than you are from chewing tobacco, smoking cigarettes, which means it would be more responsible for us to teach children that smoking tobacco, and chewing tobacco are just lifestyle choices. You know, it's like whether you want to wear, do you want to wear a blue suit or would you like to wear a gray suit when you go to your business meeting? It's a choice. That's all lifestyle choice. Well, in fact, it's not. Homosexuality is not a lifestyle choice. It's a death style choice insofar as people who make this choice, at least in the 1980s and into the 1990s, they were literally engaging in a life, in an alleged lifestyle that would shorten their life by 20 years or more. Now, whether the homosexual community still loses as many years of life today, if they do they shorten their longevity as much today as they did in 1980, 1990s? Is that, do they suffer the same loss today as they did back then? I don't know. But I will make you a bet that if there was any evidence to suggest that homosexuals lived 1 year more than heterosexuals, I guarantee that evidence would be, we'd never hear the end of it. President Obama would be talking about it, the Congress would be talking about it, and you can live an extra, get an extra year of life if you're homosexual. We'd never hear the end of it. My point in all of this is that the homosexuals need to understand that this is not a lifestyle choice. If you want to make the choice, just make the choice, right? But recognize that as a consequence of making this choice, on average, you're going to shorten your lifestyle probably more so than if you smoke tobacco. All right? There's a good chance you're going to still lose at least 10, 20, maybe more years of life by virtue of this life, this alleged lifestyle choice. And that's what I'm complaining about. People want to be gay? Be gay. I don't care. But don't feed me a bunch of nonsense about this is a lifestyle choice. It is not. It is a form of slow suicide. It's a situation where the homosexuals are chasing around and literally screwing each other to death. You understand that? This lifestyle, the fundamental distinction in this lifestyle is not the sex act per se, but a loss of longevity that is considerable. And you are left to wonder, why would any rational and intelligent man or woman choose a lifestyle that in fact was likely to significantly shorten his life expectancy? It's not good sense. If the homosexual community itself may not be aware, I doubt that they're largely unaware. I suspect they understand what I've just said. But maybe they're not. And if they're not aware, why is it that they aren't screaming at their congressmen, their senators, their presidents? Why aren't these people telling them the truth? The information has been available to years, for years, just like we were talking earlier in the program. Evidence, a report that gun control, increased gun control translates into increased crime rates. That's not new. People have understood that, at least intuitively, for some time. But we are only beginning to hear about the evidence. They're not even hearing about the evidence as to this homosexuality is hazardous to your health. And that's my point on all of this. Somebody needs to talk about this, in part to give homosexuals a real choice, where they say, this is crazy, man. I'm going to lose 10, 20 years of my life if I keep this up. And also make an intelligent choice for children. Huh? Who are being told, oh, it's a lifestyle choice. No, it's not. It's a death style choice. That's what it comes down to. That information needs to be made available to ordinary people. And when will that information be generally made available to ordinary people? Don't know. You know, I'm trying to make that information a little bit available here today. I've tried on other occasions and will undoubtedly try in the future, but not about hate. It's about trying to get the truth out there. And it's a truth that, so far as I can see, the homosexuals don't want to talk about. And the people in government who advocate laws to protect the homosexuals, they don't want to talk about. And you've got to wonder, what motivates people to not only engage in dangerous behavior, but protect a right to engage in dangerous behavior? Something that's likely to shorten your life expectancy 10, 20 years. I'm not just talking about skiing, not just talking about riding around in your snowmobile or engaging in other behavior that's a little bit risky. I'm talking about a persistent lifestyle choice likely to close you down for 10, 20 years early. What is wrong with people who would make that choice? Because there is something wrong with them. What else have we got? Jay Carney, you're talking about Obamacare, no magic number for Obamacare enrollments. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney on Monday downplayed initial projections that 7 million Americans would enroll in Obamacare by the end of March, even though the administration officials previously touted that figure. In other words, people aren't signing up for Obamacare as fast as they had hoped. It's evidence that Obamacare is not as successful as they hoped it would have been. And now they are backtracking and say, well, initially they said they predicted that there'd be 7 million Americans who'd sign up by March. Doesn't look like that's going to happen. Now they're saying, well, it doesn't matter. And in fact, they go down to the, and they there's not some magic number, Carney insisted. The makeup, the mix of enrollees is more important than the total number. See, that's what's important. Not the total number. If we don't get 7 million people, no big deal. The important thing is we get some people, and some of them are Republicans, some of them are Democrats, and some of them are young, and some of them are old. And the mix, that's the important thing. What's important is that this is simply another illustration of the fact that Obamacare is not doing well. There is a possibility that Obamacare may cease to exist. Could even happen this year, although I don't think the Republicans will allow Obamacare to fail this year. They want to use Obamacare as hot coals over which they can roast the Democrats in next November's election. So they don't want to let Obamacare go. But the truth of the matter is, if it wasn't for Republican support right now, the Democrats might be more than willing and even able to find a way to at least restrict, amend, modify Obamacare in a way that it made it less offensive, less dangerous to the Democratic Party. Here's this other article, deals with the same thing, and it 11 attorney generals, this is Washington Times again, 11 attorney generals, Obama breaking law with health care changes. Now, that's interesting. That's a pretty good headline. Now, the Washington Times is a right-wing Republican publication, so I guess we can't put that much in the headline, but Obama breaking law. President is breaking law. And this is coming from 11 attorneys general, state attorneys general. It goes on, says 11 state attorneys general have signed a letter to Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius, arguing that the administration is violating the law by making repeated changes to President Obama's health care overhaul without congressional approval. Congress enacted Obamacare without reading it. As Nancy Pelosi said, you have to vote for it so then you can find out what's in it. Well, they did, and it was sucked. What was in it sucked. But regardless, the Congress enacted it, and the president signed it, but now the president is changing rules and regulations with regard to Obamacare that are effectively changing the law. And he has no authority to do this. It is illegal. It is criminal. Right? And we have 11 state attorney generals. That's over 20% of the attorney generals in the state are contacting the Secretary of Health and Human Services to tell her that President Obama is breaking the law. Now, this is interesting in part because, let me see, I've got another report on this. Here we have the Washington Times, day or so ago. Obama's catch-me-if-you-can government lands him on most corrupt list. That's the headline. The nonprofit government watchdog Judicial Watch released its most recent annual list of 10 most wanted corrupt politicians this week, and both political parties take a hit. House Speaker John Boehner's there, as well as former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. But topping the list, President Obama, for his catch-me-if-you-can manner of governing, and this is according to Judicial Watch. On its website, the watchdog group wrote, House Speaker John Boehner has apparently become a master at what Government Accountability Institute President Peter Schweitzer calls the toll booth strategy, or when politicians charge interested parties money to move bills through the legislative process. You got a bill? Going to help you out? Going to make your corporation more profitable? People in Congress are there. They can make that bill move through the process or allow it to die. And the difference is not whether the bill is good or bad. The difference is whether or not the corporations or parties who seek to benefit from that law are willing to grease the skids by paying congressmen. Mr. Boehner has used that money to collect more than $200,000 in political donations from executives just days before holding votes on bills critically important to their industries. Now, so Boehner is on the list of the top 10 most corrupt politicians in the country. Mrs. Clinton made the list for her famous Benghazi testimony, during which she responded to a question about the source of the attack by saying, "What difference does it make?" Judicial Watch also said, in addition to Hillary Clinton's apparent cover-up of the role she played in the Benghazi tragedy and its aftermath, she left office in another ethical cloud about conflicts of interest in the activities of her longtime top aide, Huma Abedin. Right. So Mrs. Clinton is on the list of top 10. Also on the list, CIA Director John Brennan, Senator Saxby Chambliss, Attorney General Eric Holder, former IRS Commissioner Stephen Miller, and former IRS Head Lois Lerner, former Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano, Senator Harry Reid, and Health and Human Secretary Kathleen Sebelius also made the list. But leading the list, Mr. Obama. We'll get back to Mr. Obama when we return. We can take a break for a couple minutes. Be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned.
Countries have denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a Ku band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click satellite system.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, folks, I'm Alfred Adask on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. We were reading from an article on the Washington Times entitled "Obama's Catch Me If You Can, Government Lands Him on Most Corrupt List." Judicial Watch, I've been aware of Judicial Watch, I'll bet you 15 years at least, maybe 20. Judicial Watch has been around. They published an annual list of 10 most wanted corrupt politicians, and it includes Speaker John Boehner, Hillary Clinton, CIA director, former CIA John Brennan, Senator Saxby Chambliss, Attorney General Eric Holder, IRS Commissioner Stephen Miller, former IRS head Lois Lerner, former Department of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano, Harry Reid, Senator Harry Reid, and Health and Service Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, but leading the list, Mr. Obama. President Obama actually tops this 10 most wanted corrupt politicians list for 2013. as the driving force behind so many misdeeds. This is Obama's seventh straight year on the list, dating back all the way to 2007. That's before he was even in the White House. He is a master at catch-me-if-you-can corrupt politics, Judicial Watch wrote. This year, he has again acted as a one-man Congress, rewriting entire sections of the federal law on his own. Not only is his administration secretive and dishonest, its callous disregard for the rule of law undermines our constitutional republic. Among Mr. Obama's worst offense, Obamacare, and his continual lies about the ability of Americans to keep their own health insurance, Judicial Watch said. Well, it's interesting. I mean, Judicial Watch, it's not the same thing as Time Magazine, and they have a certain amount of credibility. They're not the same thing as Time Magazine or an indictment. But we just a moment ago, we were talking about 11 attorney generals who are writing to the Secretary of Health and and Human Services. 11 of them saying, look, Obama is engaged in criminal activity here. He can't be changing the Obamacare laws unilaterally. He can enforce it. He can execute the law insofar as it's been passed by Congress, but he can't unilaterally change the law, and yet that's what he's been doing. And it's not just some right-wing lunatics who are complaining about Obama's criminal behavior. It's 11 state attorneys general. We have a government. This is the kind of argument where you sit back and you say, you know, this does not bode well for the American people. It does not bode well for the American economy. We have a government that is openly corrupt. We listed half a dozen or ten. Well, of course, the list is politicians, so of course they'd be in the federal government. But significant figures. We're not talking about some sleazy little congressman working on the sly, making a few bucks on the side. We are talking about primary figures in government, including the President of the United States, whose behavior appears to be corrupt and illegal. And you sit and you wonder, is anybody going to do anything about that? Or are we going to just sit here and kind of note what's happening, but not do anything, not demand something be done? You know, we're going to have an election this November, and it would be a good idea to express your ire at any corrupt politician that you can vote against. If you have evidence that a politician is corrupt, and I don't care if he's a Republican or a Democrat, black, white, straight, or gay, the question should be, is the SOB corrupt? And if you can find evidence that the SOB, the incumbent, has engaged in corrupt acts, then you vote him out, without regard to whether he happens to be a member of your favorite political party. You vote out the corrupt and vote in whatever new candidate is coming, at least claiming that he will have a measure of integrity and honor when he gets into the Congress, the Senate, the White House, wherever. I don't pretend that everybody who, or even a majority of the candidates who come up and say, well, I'm an honest man, I have integrity, I have honor, I will not betray the American people, I don't pretend that everybody who makes those claims is honest. You know, that's kind of, it's the sort of promises, lip service that we all want to hear and we might be tempted to vote for. And then when they do get into office, you find out they're just as corrupt as the last idiot that was in there. But Americans, if we had a habit of removing anyone from office without regard to political affiliation, if they are dishonest, if they're corrupt, if they violate the Constitution, you throw them out. I don't care if it's your mother or your father who's been elected to that office. If they have violated the Constitution, if they are corrupt and dishonest, you vote them out at the next possible election. If we, the people, were prepared to do that, we would see a lot less corruption in government. And whatever corruption was there would be concealed and hidden would be right out in the open where everyone can look at it and be amazed by it. Yeah. Let me just check a list here and see if we've got any. No. All right. So I think it'd be a good idea. I think it's something that people should think about. It's very difficult to do. And part of the reason it's hard to do is precisely because we have a two-party system. We are led to believe that the principal determinant of whether a man or woman will do well, or at least do what you think is well and what I think is well in Congress, is whether they are affiliated with the Republican Party or the Democrat Party. If they are Republicans and I'm a Democrat, I will merrily vote them out if they're corrupt. But if the candidate who's corrupt is a Democrat, that's, well, that's different. We'll wink at that. We'll let that go because I'm a Democrat and he's a Democrat, and we got to stick together. We've got to have loyalty. You know, my party, right or wrong. And our party loyalty, our tendency to identify with a party, strips us of our capacity to evaluate whether a particular official is good, bad, indifferent, whether he's honest or corrupt, honorable or dishonorable. We can't see it because we are blinded by party labels. We believe in conservatism, or we believe in liberalism. And we will excuse any member, if we believe in liberalism, then we will excuse any Democrat who commits criminal acts. It's necessary to advance the cause of liberalism. Likewise, if we're conservative and a Republican violates the law, we will tend to excuse that violation because he's a Republican, and Republicans are needed to restore conservatism, even if those Republicans are crooks. If we didn't have those two parties, we would be more objective about identifying a particular candidate and saying, you know, this guy over here by the name of Jones, this guy's a crook. And we would vote him out because we would not be blinded by our party affiliation. If that were to happen, we would probably have a much more honorable Congress than we do right now. Let's see, what else have we got? Here's reader's comment. Hi, guys. Glad you're back. This came in by email. Man, woman, don't know, signed the email Ho, H-O, perhaps someone of Asian background. Hi, guys. Glad you're back. Heard you talking about the Jubilee and the banks getting bailed out. Not sure where I heard it, but if they had given the bank bailouts to the American public, every single household would have received $293,000. Now tell me that wouldn't have jump-started the economy. Every household receiving $293,000 to spend, I'd buy gold, silver, and junior mining shares. Take care, best wishes, and good luck as we enter 2014. Ho, ho, thank you. We appreciate you sending an email to us. More than likely, the number that you heard is inaccurate. I haven't had time to really research this, but a quick calculation of quantitative easing and other stimulus programs since 2008, just quick, the number is at least $2.5 trillion, and it's probably more than that. All right. Now, let's assume that government has spent $3 trillion on quantitative easing or the other stimulus programs since 2008. And I don't know that number is correct, but it's perhaps roughly correct. So let's just assume they spent $3 trillion. And then divide that sum by the population, 310 million. And the result is about $10,000 for every man, woman, and child in this country. That's not a lot, especially if it's divided out over a period of 5 years. It's $2,000 a year. That's the real extent, perhaps, of the quantitative easing. We've got $75 billion a month. It may be we could take a guess and say, who knows? Maybe they've spent $5 trillion trying to stimulate the economy. Allegedly, trying to stimulate the economy. They've given $5 trillion. to banks and or the federal government. Altogether, in the last 5 years, say $5 trillion. And I doubt that it's more than that. But even there, divide that. We're still talking, I don't know, let's say $20,000 per person. $20,000 per person over a period of 5 years. Not an extraordinary amount. So, I think I'm inclined, until I see more accurate figures, and my numbers may be far too low, but until I see more accurate figures, I doubt that they've spent $293,000 for each household. That'd probably translate into, what, a fourth of that? Something like $70,000 per person. I doubt that that's been spent. So it's one of those things that happens on the internet, and we see the stories on the internet, and they may not be true. They might be exaggerated. What else have we got? IMF papers, Perth Mint, crowds grow. Here's one. Crowds grow like weeds for the first legal sales of marijuana in Colorado. This is in the Washington Times. Colorado lit the nation's first legal adult marijuana market shortly after dawn on Wednesday last week, and Brandon Harris was not about to miss it. Tells the story of Brandon and his friend drove all the way from Blanchester, Ohio, for the big opening. It was a cause for celebration among a lot of people. They're allowing people to buy marijuana legally in Colorado. For the first time in history, adults are able to purchase marijuana legally in a controlled environment as opposed to in the underground market. This was Mason Dvert, who ran the Amendment 64 campaign, and he was speaking at a press conference outside the 3D Cannabis Center. He was apparently one of the prime movers in getting the state law in Colorado changed where they allow people to buy marijuana there. So what do you think? Is it good or bad that marijuana be legalized? I'm not asking, is it good or bad that people do drugs? But is it good or bad that marijuana be legalized? And the truth of the matter is, I don't see good reason to believe that it's bad. Right? I think, you know, marijuana has been around for, you know, as long as the planet's been around. Certainly longer than we have. It's a natural substance. It does not. There is no literature that I'm aware of that suggests that marijuana is conducive to violence or criminal behavior. Other than eating too many brownies, perhaps. And getting a bad case of the munchies, a felonious case of the munchies. But it doesn't hurt people in the sense, typically, it doesn't hurt people in the sense of causing people to pull a gun and shoot people, knife people, whatever. It doesn't happen. We can wonder about whether marijuana, how much damage marijuana costs, because people who are driving while they're stoned on marijuana may be unable to drive effectively. That's another question. But the same question is available for alcohol. And the same question is available for people who use cell phones in their automobiles. You know? On balance, I'd have to say that it's a good thing that they legalized marijuana, not because I think it's good to do marijuana, but because I think the consequences of this regulation and making it a felony and so on, it's just flooded prisons. It's done a lot of harm to society that wasn't necessary. The cure was worse than the disease. I'm out of time. I want to thank you for listening. I'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Frank, the producer. Bye-bye.